Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Thursday, March 14th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Teresa Whitaker and Scott Splavik. Here's our first story. Pre-eclipse viewing party. The solar eclipse is on April 8th. This is by Olivia Allen. April's solar eclipse is nearing, and students at John Deere Middle School in Moline are prepared to watch with a clear yet safe view. Thanks to a four-year partnership with the popular Astronomy Club of the Quad Cities, the school held a pre-eclipse viewing session on Tuesday. Deere students and families got to practice their solar eclipse viewing using a high-grade astrophotography camera and solar-filtered MEAD LX200 telescope to view the sun. Dylan Sitko, an eighth grader at Deere, said he got a small telescope for Christmas as a child, but it was nothing like this. They had a video device attached to a telescope, so we didn't really have to look directly into the telescope to see the sun, he said. Dylan and a group of three peers, Ava Davis, Olivia Glenz, and Allie Jones, agreed that learning about sunspots was the most notable takeaway from Tuesday's viewing session. I noticed that there were multiple sunspots, Ava said. If they're darker, that means they're lower in temperature. She and Olivia recalled a similar activity with their science teacher, Chad Potter, and the popular astronomers. Only then they got a glimpse of Saturn. That was also really cool because I hadn't ever seen space with such, like, high technology, Olivia said. It's always fascinated me ever since I was younger. My dad got me into astronomy, so it was really cool seeing this today, something other than what we saw earlier with Saturn. It was Allie's first time using such high-grade telescopic equipment. For my first solar eclipse, I think it was a really cool experience, she said. You had to wear the glasses and really focus in to really know what was going on. That was really just an opportunity that I really wanted to take. The local popular astronomy club also led a presentation on the sun and solar viewing safety, urging the following key tips. Never look directly into the sun. Only use solar glasses stamped with an ISO specification indicating approval for solar eclipse viewing. If you don't have access to the appropriate glasses, attend a viewing event that provides an appropriate solar eclipse telescope. It's really nice to have experts in the field come out and talk to kids about astronomy because it's not one of my strong suits, Potter said, adding astrophotography has become a tradition at John Deere. They make a lot of this information interesting for the kids. Deere will also host a solar eclipse viewing on April 8th in place of their normal seventh period. Recent developments in space exploration via the James Webb Telescope, coupled with other eclipses within the past few years, has triggered both an uptick in nationwide publicity and local interest, said Dale Hechtel, president of Popular Astronomy Club of the Quad Cities. That has sparked a lot of interest in answering questions like, is there life out there? What's going on out there? He said on Tuesday. Even if some of these kids have their own small telescopes, they don't get to look at space through the higher quality apertures some of these you'd call a professional astronomy telescope. You can look at some things you just couldn't see otherwise. The popular astronomers donated 300 pairs of solar viewing glasses for this event, which students can earn via Deere's Behavior Incentive Program. Deere students will be able to cash in 50 Spartan bucks, awarded for good behavior during the school day, for a pair of the glasses. The partnership between Popular Astronomy Club QC and Deere began after Potter wanted to better understand an old telescope he found in storage. Alan Schiedler, a former Popular Astronomy Club president, volunteered to teach him about the telescope and even rebuild its electronics board. He's also advised John Deere's purchase of four new telescopes and various high-quality eyepieces, even dedicating a new astrophotography camera. I think a lot of my students are just naturally intrigued by astronomy, Potter said. Just looking up into the sky, they find it all interesting. While students may not want to pursue astronomy as a career, they voice these natural curiosities. I still think that I've learned some cool stuff, and I think it's all really interesting, Dylan said. I think it's cool they, the popular astronomers, teach kids about what's out there. Tuesday's activities are part of a roughly 20 part of roughly 20 programs available at John Deere via Lights On for Learning, a 5-year federal grant program that supports various before and after school enrichment opportunities at no cost to students and families. I wasn't sure what to exactly expect, Ava said of Tuesday's solar viewing activity, but I'm glad that I took the chance to do it. I think it's astronomy is fascinating, she added. I mean, who wouldn't?
Thanks, Teresa. Our next article is entitled Pleasant Valley Recount Suit Dismissed. Jamison Smith defeated Tracy Rivera by 6 votes. It's written by Olivia Allen of the Quad City Times. A Scott County judge granted a motion to dismiss a lawsuit regarding Pleasant Valley's Director District 6 recount. This marks the latest update in the Pleasant Valley School District and former incumbent challenger Tracy Rivera, who ran as a write-in candidate for the November 7th city/school elections. Rivera lost by 6 votes, but filed for a recount. The recount ended in a tie, but the Scott County Board rejected the results. Rivera then filed suit against the county board, asking the judge to require the board to certify the recount. On January the 8th, Smith filed a motion to intervene to join the suit as a defendant, arguing the final recount report had 2 deficiencies and 3, therefore, the rejection was correct. Meanwhile, Scott County Attorney Christina Lyon filed a motion to dismiss in defense of Scott County supervisors on Tuesday, January the 23rd. She asserted Rivera's motion was not the appropriate mechanism by which the results and process of the election and the Board of Supervisors' conduct could be revisited, and that there were alternatives codified remedies that are plain, speedy, and adequate. It's just our belief that if Ms. Rivera found that there were issues with what supervisors did, she should have and could have filed that election contest instead of pursuing the writ of mandamus, Lyons said to the Quad City Times on Wednesday. Judge Mark Fowler used this rationale in dismissing the case, maintaining that Rivera could have sought relief via an election contest. Because she did not avail herself of another plain, speedy, and adequate remedy of law, Rivera's petition for a writ of mandamus must be dismissed, the court filing states. Fowler ordered the case's dismissal on Wednesday, March the 13th. The judge reached the right result. Iowa law is clear that Tracy Rivera should have filed an election contest instead of going to court, Smith's attorney, Alan Ostergren, said via email after the ruling. It is unfortunate we were ever in this situation. If the recount board had listened to the legal advice it was given, it would have never counted invalid write-in votes in the first place. The recount was conducted by a 3-member recount board comprised of an individual selected by Smith, an individual selected by Rivera, and a 3rd court-appointed delegate. We are very disappointed by Judge Fowler's ruling to dismiss, Rivera said to the Quad City Times on Wednesday. The Scott County Board of Supervisors refused to fulfill their legal duty and accept the findings of the recount board when the Iowa Code Section 50.48 sub 5 is clear. If a recount board finds an error in the tally, the law says the county board shall reconvene within 3 days after being so notified and shall correct its previous proceedings. The county attorney's office told the supervisors the law was clear that their role was ministerial, she added, and the report should have been accepted. On the final day of the recount, November the 28th, 2023, tallies showed a tie between Rivera and Smith, though Cindy Dirks, Smith's recount delegate, objected, citing the inclusion of write-in ballots that were filled out incorrectly. To resolve these disputes, she wanted to reconvene with county attorneys and the other recount delegates before the state's December 4th deadline. When this didn't happen, Dirks filed the final recount report reflecting the tie on Friday, December the 1st, along with four additional documents explaining her objections. She had the tally sheets in her custody from November the 28th to December the 1st, though Lyons said there was no evidence to support that the tally sheets had been altered. Still, the other delegates said they didn't know Scott County Auditor Kerry Tompkins gave the tally sheets back to Dierks after all three signed off, spurring some concerns. Scott County supervisors voted to reject the recount, reverting election results for Pleasant Valley's District 6 seat to the initial canvass subject to further litigation. Smith was seated on the Pleasant Valley School Board on Monday, November the 27th, in accordance with the school district's annual organizational meeting process. On January 5th, the Iowa Secretary of State issued a technical infraction to the recount board for failing to follow recount laws by including invalid votes for their final in their final report, despite county guidelines. Dierks had written to the Secretary of State's office to request a review of the process. No fine will be imposed for this specific infraction to the recount board, Iowa SOS Communications Director Ashley Hunt said via email. We review technical infractions and include in our training to auditors if appropriate.
Double murder suspect writes to judge. Adriana Blake faces two counts of first-degree murder. This article is by Tom Louie and Anthony Watt. The Davenport woman charged in a January double homicide has written another letter to a judge. Adriana Blake faces two counts of first-degree murder in the January 15th slaying of Brian L. Goodwin and Amy M. Smith. She first wrote to District 7 Associate Judge Michael Motto on February 25th asking for a new attorney. Her latest letter to Motto, dated March 10th, is 3.5 pages long and alleges Scott County Jail medical staff and corrections officers are ignoring her requests for assistance. Blake claims in the letter she has been denied access to medical and mental health services, as well as use of a toothbrush and toothpaste. She is scheduled to make two appearances in court Thursday, the first at 10:30 a.m. and the second at 11 a.m. The latter was Blake's originally scheduled arraignment. Blake also made a number of complaints in the newest letter about her state of mind. She describes periods of feeling delirious. Later in the letter, Blake claims she spent some of her time in the jail hallucinating. She said she thought she saw her dead husband and traveled through time and stopped him from shooting himself. While claiming she is terrified at the prospect of being housed in this jail, Blake did not ask to be moved to another facility. Devin Bryant, 34, also is charged in the deaths. He and Blake were arrested January 18th, and at that time, they were charged with being felons in possession of a firearm and various warrants. Blake and Bryant were officially charged with the murders on February 7th. Like Blake, Bryant is slated to appear in the Scott County Courthouse at 11 a.m. Thursday. They appeared in court as co-defendants on February 16th. Blake was represented by public defender Troy Smith. Bryant was represented by Amy Kepis of the Des Moines-based Special Defense Unit. In the pair's murder case, the most recent development is the assignment of District Court Judge Stuart P. Whirling as the trial judge who will oversee the proceedings, according to court documents. The appointment documents were filed on March 5th. Investigators say Blake and Bryant possessed firearms during the commission of the crimes. Arresting officers said that when Blake and Bryant were taken into custody on January 18th, they had 4.3 grams of heroin and 11 grams of meth. Bryant and Blake are charged with two counts each of first-degree murder, assault while participating in a felony causing serious injury, and abuse of a corpse. The pair also are charged with one count each of second-degree arson, going armed with intent, possession of a firearm by a felon, use of a dangerous weapon in the commission of a crime, and possession of a controlled substance. In a letter written on February 25th, Blake asked Motto for a different attorney and named private attorneys Andrea Jaeger and Eric, for whom she does not give a last name. The second could be Jaeger's partner, Eric Tyndall, at the law firm Keegan, Tyndall, and Jaeger. Blake claimed she is not being adequately represented by Smith. Troy Smith also told me when I had court on the 16th that he would be here last week to speak with me and never came, Blake wrote in the letter. Smith has filed with the court asking for a judge to hear Blake's concerns. When Blake was originally arrested on January 18th, she was booked under the name Adriana Prieto. In the letter, Blake asks for all her documentation to show her last name as Blake. She said she was married on July 4, 2023, and has identification showing her married name. The bodies of Goodwin and Smith, both 44, were found January 16th by Davenport firefighters after a fire was reported at Goodwin's residence at 5210 North Division Street. They had gunshot wounds. According to their arrest affidavits, Blake and Brandt also lived at the residence. Under Iowa law, first-degree murder carries an automatic sentence of life in prison upon conviction. During the February 16th court hearing, Davenport police investigator Brandon Askew testified that Blake was recorded on video in a hotel room in Galesburg, Illinois, bragging about killing two people. Askew also testified that Blake and Brandt were in possession of the firearms believed to be used in the murders when they were arrested on January 18th. According to the arrest affidavits, Blake and Brandt killed Goodwin and Smith between 4:30 and 7 a.m. on Monday, January 15th. Another woman also was arrested February 7th in connection with the case. Melissa Marie Weber, 49, is charged with two counts of abuse of a corpse and one count each of accessory after the fact and second-degree arson. Blake and Brandt, along with Weber, placed combustible materials inside the residence where the bodies of Goodwin and Smith were located, authorities allege. They set fire to the materials in the hopes of altering the crime scene. The fire damaged the bodies of Goodwin and Smith. After helping to start the fire, Weber helped Blake and Brandt avoid apprehension, the affidavit said. Weber is being held in the Rock Island County Jail for Scott County.
Our next article is entitled, Augie Grad Creates Fertility Kit. Ferdahl received FDA approval in December of 2023. This is written by Olivia Allen of the Quad City Times. For a while, Jen Hinsky didn't want to talk about her infertility. Now, she's the proud founder and CEO of Ferdahl Fertility Science, Inc., the only sterile at-home insemination kit cleared by the Food and Drug Administration, and has two children herself. Hinsky graduated from Augustana College in the year 2006, where she was a biochemistry major and chemistry minor. Still, she says the trajectory of her career was an unlikely one. "You couldn't have paid me $1 million to guess this is where I'd be," Hinsky said. However, one of her biology professors at Augie, Dara Wegman-Geedy, always had faith in this success. "What I love about Jen's product is that she followed that logic that we nudge students to use, even in a research paper. We don't want them to use these obscure, contrived, really complex concepts. We want them to look at it logically, reduce it down to the common factors, and then consider what is the next step. And that is what she did," Wegman-Geedy said in an Augie press release. "It's not just the science, it's the ethics, the inquiry, the communication." After Augie, Hinsky went on to earn her doctorate in bioinformatics using software tools to analyze biological data from Northern Illinois University. But she didn't think she fit that mold. "I went into software development for companies helping safety net hospitals," she said, though she'd later shift to precision oncology research. Things started to change yet again once Hinsky and her husband, Ryan, hoped to begin their family. "The diagnosis of unexplained infertility is rarely what set off this whole, is really what set off this whole chain of events," she said. "I mean, they couldn't even tell me what was wrong with me. That was the first time I had to start advocating for my own health." Having an extensive background in scientific research, Hinsky knew her options spanned beyond the $10,000 treatment doctors recommended, leading her down the rabbit hole of at-home insemination. Hinchke said she cobbled together the first two Firdall kits using supplies ordered via the cancer research lab she worked in at the time. In January of 2018, evidence to support Firdall emerged. Hinchke was pregnant with her now 5-year-old daughter, Lois. After 16 months of infertility, this positive pregnancy test came within only 2 months of using Firdall. People would ask me, "How come you waited a year to have kids?" And I would say, "I didn't wait. We couldn't conceive," Hinchke said. People are like, "Oh, I just thought you were in PhD or climbing the corporate ladder." And I'm like, "Yeah, but I wanted to be a mom." She soon realized how many other aspiring moms also must battle infertility, prompting her to take action. Not everyone has access to research lab supplies and the ability to decipher scientific journals on reproduction, Hinchke said. "So I really started just helping any friends that opened up to me. It was the best feeling, just knowing I could help someone not feel alone and not feel helpless going through that process." After further soul searching, she decided to bring Firdall to the market. "My husband came home one day and I was like, 'I want to make Lois Makers,'" Hinchke said. "Infertility is one of the hardest things couples can go through. I just want people to experience the joy we're fortunate enough to have." Firdall released its first 200 at-home kits, initially registered as a Class 1 medical device under the FDA in the year 2021, selling out within 90 days. One night, Hinchke got a chance to meet the second baby conceived with Firdall and her parents. That helped convince her to take Firdall further. Of the first 200 Firdall kits, 34 babies, including a pair of siblings, were born, a 17% success rate. The FDA gave Firdall full clearance in December of 2023. "This was no cheap endeavor," Hinchke said, "though it was entirely crowdfunded. I realized, like, literally, my only option was to get over the embarrassment of telling people about my infertility," she said, "because I needed to tell the world about Firdall. 433 people invested anywhere from $250,000 to $50,000. I bet you that should be $500,000. Anyway, so those people now own shares of the company with me. Calling her crowdfunding efforts Guinness Book of World Records worthy, Hinchke sold another percentage of Firdall to secure the remaining funds needed for FDA clearance. That was all because people rallied around wanting to market Firdall, she said. "Now it's here. I owe all of that to every one of those 433 people who believed in us. I just keep hoping I can make them proud." Upon learning the FDA cleared Firdall, Hinchke said her reaction was a blur. "It's a very tedious process," she said, noting how crowdfunding alone took an entire year. "Without pay, like, every last penny went towards getting our FDA clearance." Still, Hinchke remembers tears. "The next 3 weeks was probably a blur of excitement because really the race is just started, but also so much gratitude that people trusted me and I didn't let them down," she said. "We made history." From there, Hinchke said she got to work, ordering inventory, printing business documents, and preparing to scale. "It just didn't seem real," she said. "I'm excited because now we get to the good part where we help people. That's why we started it." Firdall kits cost $200 and arrive by mail in discreet packaging, allowing families to conduct safe, sterile insemination from the privacy of their own home. Firdall delivers directly to the cervix, Hinchke said. "It really gives you the closest thing you can get to the first line of clinical fertility treatment." Regardless of the route families want to take, Hinchke encourages all to open up about infertility. 1 in 5 women struggle for over a year to conceive, she said. "Just sharing your story helps us shed light on this incredibly pervasive topic that no one wants to talk about." For people who don't want to share their own story, Hinchke gives them permission to share hers. "Even if we can't help you, I'd love everyone to just share my story at least," she said. so we can normalize infertility and help people at the same time in giving them the dignity and privacy of doing it in their own home first. To order your own kit or learn more, visit www.ferdahl.com.
Morse, running for Scott County Sheriff, currently works as a Davenport police officer. It's by Sarah Watson. Davenport Police Corporal Gordon Morse announced this week he plans to seek the Democratic nomination for Scott County Sheriff. Morse previously launched a write-in campaign in 2020 as an independent for sheriff and said he was motivated to run again, this time on the ballot for the Democratic nomination. Morse said he intends to prioritize the formation of an interagency unit that can more effectively respond to calls where someone is experiencing a mental health crisis that can be de-escalated without an arrest. A general response by an officer may inflame or cause more issues, Morse said. I spent 15 years as a detective, and I've recently gone back to patrol and started seeing the number of calls, especially in the downtown area of Davenport, where the officers are just going from some type of mental health call to another, and eventually that leads to an arrest sometimes to solve the problem. Also, he said he would work to raise wages for correctional officers and restructure to alleviate staffing shortages and focus on addressing juvenile crime. Morse, too, said he would place a higher priority on rural areas of the county. He said smaller agencies have told him they don't receive as much support from the sheriff's office as larger communities such as Davenport. I think I bring an idea that the needed change and evolution of the sheriff's office from where it's at and where it needs to change in the future, Morse said. Morse, 52, was hired in 1992 as a corrections officer for the Scott County Sheriff's Office. In 1993, he joined the U.S. Coast Guard and was stationed in Galveston, where he was deployed as part of operations that responded to mass migration from Haiti and Cuba in the mid-1990s. He's worked at the Davenport Police Department since 2000, where he's worked as a patrol officer, evidence technician, field training officer, street supervisor, and detective. He's also been a bomb technician with the Quad City Bomb Squad since 2004. Morse is one of four candidates who've announced bids for the position. Scott County Sheriff's Lieutenant Thomas Gibbs announced earlier this year he intends to seek the Democratic nomination for sheriff. For the Republican nomination, incumbent Tim Lane, the county's sheriff since 2016, and Scott County Sheriff's Deputy Chris Lay have announced their plan to run. The primary will be June 4th, and the general election will be November 5th. Candidates running for county office must file their paperwork for the 2024 primary race between March 4th and March 22nd.
Bicyclist killed in crash Tuesday. Crash occurred on North Division Street. This is written by Thomas Geyer. A bicyclist was killed Tuesday after being struck by a vehicle, Davenport police said. The crash occurred around 3:39 p.m. in the 7,000 block of North Division Street. Police said the initial investigation indicates a pickup was southbound on Division Street when it struck the bicyclist, a 27-year-old man. The bicyclist was pronounced dead at the scene. The driver of the pickup, a 54-year-old man, was taken to a local hospital for evaluation. The names are being withheld pending family notifications. The Davenport Police Department's Traffic Safety Unit is investigating the crash. And RIPD selects name for new canine, also written by Thomas Geyer. A name for its newest canine officer, Blue, was chosen by the children of Officer Alex Bowman, who will again serve as canine handler, according to a news release issued by the city. The name was announced during Monday's city council meeting. During the week-long naming contest, 1,313 submissions were received in the city's and police department's Facebook pages. After removing duplicates, there were 720 unique names remaining. The list was narrowed to 10, and Blue was chosen. When we decided to get the public's input into naming our new canine, we couldn't imagine how much or our community would jump in and start making so many great suggestions, Deputy Police Chief Tim McLeod said. It was hard to keep up with all the submissions, he added. Blue is a 14-month-old Belgian Malinois German Shepherd Mix from Cedar Creek Kennels in Monmouth, Illinois. An anonymous donor and supporter of K9 programs stepped forward and contributed $10,000 toward the purchase and training of a new police dog for the department after the sudden passing of K9 Sparky Jackson after a medical procedure. Bowman will go through 10 weeks of training with Blue at Cedar Creek Kennels starting at the end of March.
Okay, you're listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we're going to turn to today's obituaries. Out of Davenport, Frances Dorothy Moritz, 88, of Davenport, passed away Monday, March 4th. Funeral service will be held at 12 p.m. on Saturday, March 16th, at the Runge Mortuary. Visitation will be held at 11 a.m. prior to the service. She will be laid to rest at Davenport Memorial Park. Memorials may be made in her name to the Bluegrass Legion Auxiliary 711. Online condolences may be expressed at www.rungemortuary.com. Frances was born in Davenport on February 26, 1936, to Frank and Francisca Petsonka Selman. She married Dale Moritz on October 24, 1959, in Davenport. He preceded her in death on January 12, 2007. She was a member of the Bluegrass Legion Auxiliary 711, AARP, and the Plus 60 Club. Her interests included playing bingo, feeding and watching birds, gardening, and tending to her roses. She was employed for 25 years at the Rock Island Arsenal. She is survived by her brother-in-law, Richard Moritz, and several nieces, nephews, great-nieces, and great-nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents and her husband. Catherine Rafferty, 100, of Davenport, passed away Saturday, March 9th, at the Call Home in Davenport. The rite of cremation was accorded, and a mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. on Monday, March 18th, at St. Anthony's Catholic Church in Davenport, with visitation from 9 a.m. until time of services. Interment will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Davenport. Memorials may be made to St. Anthony's Care and Share Program. Arrangements by Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. Catherine Jeanette Mulholland was born September 26, 1923, in DeWitt, a daughter of Clement Matthew and Elsie Marie Shea Mulholland. She was united in marriage to George Rafferty on May 25, 1948, in DeWitt, and he preceded her in death August 5, 1989. She was a hard worker and often held two jobs, including CNA at the former Mercy Hospital and Fajervary Nursing Home, photographer's assistant at Portraits by Annette, office staff at St. Anthony's, and volunteered at the McAnthony's Window. Her family was most important to her, and her sense of humor and infectious laugh will be deeply missed. Survivors include her children, Mary Pat, spouse Mark Kinneman of Rockford, Illinois, Kathleen, spouse Joe Lakers of Cape Coral, Florida, Jean, spouse Ron Warner Malloy of Davenport, George, Bill, spouse Diana Rafferty, Davenport, grandchildren Kathy, Emily, Mark, Tony, Amy, Ryan, Leah, Randy, Colleen, Dan, Seth, 16 great-grandchildren, and 7 great-great-grandchildren. In addition to her husband, George, she was preceded in death by her daughter, Deborah, spouse Michael Feddersen, and sisters Mary McGarry, Margaret Trumpeter, and Patricia Wolfe. Michael Mike Irwin, 54, of Moline, passed away March 11th at Unity Point Health Trinity. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, March 16th, at Esterdahl Mortuary and Crematory Limited, Moline. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday at the funeral home. Interment will be at Greenview Memorial Gardens. Memorials may be made to the Educational and Soccer Fund for Gabriel. Mike was born on October 7, 1969, in Moline, Illinois, the son of Donna M. Mess and Marvin G. Irwin. He married Gretchen D. Fick on October 29, 2005, in Moline. Mike was known to be a sports card enthusiast and was a Notre Dame football fan. Mike loved spending time with his son, from watching him play soccer for QC Rush to playing fantasy football together. Survivors include his wife Gretchen, son Gabriel Irwin, mother Donna Irwin, his dog Angel, mother and father-in-law, Mark and Dee Fick, sister-in-law and brother-in-law, Amanda and Randy Cashman, nephew Marcus, nieces Morgan and Mackenzie. He was preceded in death by his father, Marvin. Gail Spike Koss, C-O-S-S, of LeClaire. Funeral services for Gail Spike Koss, 92, of LeClaire, will be 5 p.m. on Saturday at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Burial will take place at Durant Cemetery in Durant, Iowa. Family will greet friends on Saturday from 4 p.m. to service time at the funeral home. Gail passed away on Tuesday, March 12th, at the Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. Gail was born on May 11, 1931, in Fredericksburg, the son of Lewis and Olive Conklin Koss. He married Carla M. Mordhorst on July 19, 1952, in Davenport. She preceded him in death on October 28, 2020. Gail worked as a commercial fisherman for many years while also working at J.J. Case and Adele, retiring in 1996. Gail enjoyed hunting, fishing, and camping. He was a member of Moose Lodge, No. 28, and Ducks Unlimited. He golfed in the Hidden Hills two-man best ball golf league. Survivors include his children, Gayla, spouse Jesse Cook of Rock Island, Illinois, and Candy, spouse Todd Thomas of Lamoni. Three grandchildren, three great-grandchildren, and one sister, Helen Sandman of Westminster, California. He was preceded in death by his parents, his wife, son Gordon Koss, sisters Goldie Chandler, Dorothy Erickson, Evelyn Ferris, Maxine Duncan, Phyllis Koss, brothers Stuart Koss, Louis Koss, Albert Koss, Larry Koss, and Kenneth Koss. Memorials may be directed to the family and to Ducks Unlimited.
Now here are some pendings. First, Susan R. Pickens, age 61, formerly of Cambridge, passed away on Sunday, March the 10th at Genesis Medical Center in Silvis. Cremation has been accorded and a memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, March the 15th at Cambridge Chapel of Stackhouse Moore Funeral and Cremation Service. Lyle Eugene Thone, Theo, T-H-O-E-N-E, age 72, of Yates Center, Kansas, died February the 23rd at the KU Medical Center. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory in Moline, Illinois. John A. Proctor, age 67, of Davenport, died Tuesday, March the 12th at Harmony Utica Ridge, Davenport. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory in Moline, Illinois. Dale M. Shake, age 32, of Coal Valley, passed away Tuesday, March the 12th at his home. Arrangements are pending at Esterdahl Mortuary and Cremation Limited in Orion. Oaty D. George, age 89, of Geneseo, Illinois, passed away on Tuesday, March the 12th at Unity Point Health, Trinity, Rock Island. Arrangements at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan. Douglas Doug E. Nelson, age 68, of Milan, passed away on Tuesday, March the 12th, at home. Arrangements are with Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Cremation of Milan. Samson Sullivan Sprague, age 13, of Moline, passed away Monday, March the 12th at UP Trinity, Rock Island. Arrangements are pending at Rafferty Funeral Home in Moline. Christine Huntley, age 39, of Silvis, Illinois, passed away Monday, March the 11th at Genesis Medical Center, Illini Campus, Silvis. Arrangements are pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan. Joanne Reiling, age 90, of rural Clarence, Iowa, died Tuesday, March the 12th, from complications of heart failure in St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Arrangements are pending with Fry Funeral Home, Tipton, Iowa. Louis E. Jones, age 70, of Knoxville, Illinois, passed away Tuesday, March 12th, at his residence. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial in Moline. Gary A. Masco, age 67 of Davenport, passed away on March the 6th at Genesis Medical Center East Campus. Arrangements are pending at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. Beverly Ann Bernie Eckert, age 93 of Bettendorf, passed away March the 11th at the Clarissa Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. Arrangements are with Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. And Walter L. Humphrey, age 78, of Grand Mound, Iowa, died Wednesday, March 13th, in his home. Arrangements are in the care of Schultz Funeral Home of DeWitt, Iowa.
Okay, and now we're going to turn to the opinion section and start with the Another View column out of the London Guardian. Russian opposition needs help. Elections this week are a sham, but they must not demoralize those who criticize Putin. Article 13 of the Russian Constitution promises political pluralism. Article 29 guarantees freedom of speech. It is a brave citizen who insists on those rights. Though Russia will hold a presidential election at the end of this week, the result is a foregone conclusion. Vladimir Putin will win comfortably. The spirit of post-Soviet democratization is all but dead. The flame is kept alive by a courageous few. Thousands turned out at the Moscow funeral of Alexei Navalny. The jailed opposition leader generally assumed to have been murdered by order of the Kremlin. Chants called for Russia without Putin. That is a high-risk activity. Open dissent against the regime is punishable by fines and prison sentences. OVD Info, a human rights group, has cataloged hundreds of detentions in dozens of cities after vigils in honor of Navalny. It has been the largest show of opposition since the invasion of Ukraine, but the numbers are not huge for a country of 144 million. What the majority of Russians think about their president and his war is opaque. Independent analysts say the picture is nuanced, a spectrum of sentiment with ideological pro-Kremlin conviction shading into looser patriotic sympathy with the army, and then degrees of apathy, low-level discontent, grim resignation, despair, and a kernel of committed anti-regime activists. Putin's position is secured by brute force and cultivated disbelief that any alternative is viable. He achieves this by eliminating rivals and propagating a personality cult that depicts Russia as the target of a foreign dismemberment plot and himself as the only person able to hold the country together. This week's election is not meant to fool anyone into thinking that Russians have a choice. It is a ritual affirmation of incumbent power, but even the pretense of a ballot gives the opposition something to rally around. Yulia Navalnaya, the murdered dissident's widow, has called for the anti-Putin voters to converge on polling stations at midday on Sunday, even if they don't intend to vote. The point is to be visible. These are wholly symbolic gestures, but that doesn't mean they are futile. Russians who dare to speak up for democracy and those who silently crave the end of Putin need reminding that they are not alone. There is a role also for those outside Russia who can amplify voices of courage and hope. Jailed opposition figures Ilya Yashin and Vladimir Khatramirza risk suffering the same fate as Navalny. The more conspicuous their plight, the harder it is for Putin to pretend his is the only vision of Russian politics. The freedoms that are promised in Russia's constitution feel remote today, as this week's election will sadly demonstrate. But it will show also that the spirit of opposition cannot be extinguished.
I'll read another opinion piece written by Jonah Goldberg, who is editor-in-chief of The Dispatch. And it's entitled, MAGA Movement Has Become Establishment Now. Donald Trump's domination of last week's primaries made it official. He has successfully routed the GOP establishment. Some would argue, with ample evidence, that this happened a long time ago. Particularly in Congress, the party is divided into three sometimes overlapping factions, Reaganites, pragmatists, and populists, the last being Trump's MAGA faction. Politicians from the non-MAGA faction have been retreating, retiring, or reinventing themselves in Trump's image for years now. if Republican Senators Mike Lee of Utah, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, Tim Scott of South Carolina, and Marco Rubio of Florida aren't fully MAGA in their hearts, you wouldn't know it from their current public personas. Other Republicans, including former Senators Rob Portman of Ohio, Jeff Flake of Arizona, and Bob Corker of Tennessee, along with former Representatives Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, Eric Cantor of Virginia, and Liz Cheney of Wyoming, were either shown the door or fled for it themselves. And outside institutions such as the Conservative Political Action Committee, or CPAC, and the Heritage Foundation have repositioned themselves as MAGA organs. That process has accelerated since Trump effectively locked up the Republican nomination for president for the third time. Over the past few months, non-MAGA Republicans such as Representatives Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin and Patrick McHenry of North Carolina and Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington have announced that they will be leaving Congress. And Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the last actual avatar of the GOP establishment, declared that he would not run to lead the Republican caucus again and went on to endorse Trump. The takeover is culminating with the Trumpian captivity of the Republican National Committee. Virtually no Republican establishment is left that isn't synonymous with the Trump establishment. Trump has previously described himself as a nationalist, and he at least partly rejected the conservative label in an interview with CNBC's Squawk Box on Monday. "People say, 'You're conservative,' Trump said. 'I'm not conservative. You know what I am? I'm a man of common sense, and a lot of conservative policies are common sense." Whatever we call him, what's clear is that Trump thinks his team can go it alone. At a recent Virginia rally, he declared that MAGA represents 96% and maybe 100% of the GOP. "We're getting rid of the Romneys of the world. We want to get Romneys and those like him out." Normally, general election candidates try to expand their coalitions. Primary election exit polls and the actual results belie Trump's claim that the party is now almost pure MAGA. In each of the six states with entrance and exit polls, a CNN analysis found a sizable minority of the GOP electorate identified directly as part of the MAGA or Make America Great Again movement, ranging from about one-third in California, Virginia, and New Hampshire to nearly half in Iowa. Put another way, between half and two-thirds of those primary voting Republicans don't identify as MAGA. Most will still likely hold their nose and vote for Trump in November, but that's not proof that the GOP is totally Trumpian, now a wholly owned subsidiary of Trumpism. That behooves concerned with taking over the party as taking over the government. In Republican primaries, Trump has tended to back loyalists with dim general election prospects over more traditional Republicans with a better chance of actually winning House and Senate seats. The MAGA movement seems convinced that a purer party dedicated to Trump is for some reason better than one saddled with the remnants of the old GOP coalition. For all practical purposes, their wish has been granted. That's good for the movement if Trump wins in November, but if he loses, they'll have no one to blame but themselves. After all, they're the establishment now.
Okay, I'm going to turn to the sports section and let you know what you can catch on the air at 5:30 p.m. this evening. Ohio State is playing in the Big Ten tourney. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to jump down here to where you can see what channel it's on. So starting at in men's basketball, college basketball, we've got all day long you can see anything you want. You can listen to anything you want on men's college basketball. Starting at 11 a.m., the Big Ten second round, Minnesota versus Michigan State. And again, that's on BTN. And that continues. The second round of the Big Ten is at 1:30 p.m., and then that continues again. This evening, you can catch Ohio State versus Iowa at 5:30. on BTN. And then there's a second round at 8 o'clock on BTN. You can also then catch the Big 12 tournament today. The quarterfinal is at 11:30 on ESPN2. Another quarterfinal in Big 12 is also on ESPN. And then at 6 o'clock this evening, we have a Big 12 quarterfinal with Iowa State versus someone. We have yet to be seen who they're going to play. That's on ESPN2, again at 6 o'clock. Big 12 quarterfinals at 8:30 p.m. this evening on ESPN2. So, again, there is just a lot going on. This evening you can also catch, if you don't want to watch men's college basketball, the Chicago Bulls are playing the Clippers at 7 p.m. this evening. And that's what we've got on the air. Again, there's just so many to read. I don't think I'm going to try and read them all, but that's your Big 10 and Big 12 quarterfinals. I'm going to turn it over to Scott for an article.
I'm going to read about the women's basketball tournament that's taking place in the Quad Cities this weekend. And the story is entitled Something Special in the Quad Cities. MVC Teams Excited for Another Vibrant Experience. Written by Tom Johnston of the Quad City Times. For the ninth time in league history, Hoops in the Heartland returns to the Quad Cities this week as the Missouri Valley Conference's women's basketball tournament tips off Thursday afternoon. And that means the chase for a coveted NCAA tournament bid will again run through Vibrant Arena at the Mark in downtown Moline. By Sunday afternoon, one of the 12 MVC schools will be in full celebration mode. Hosting its ninth annual event, the Hoops in the Heartland has cemented itself as the nation's longest-running standalone neutral site women's basketball tournament in the country. It is the 17th straight year that the Valley has held its women's basketball tournament at a neutral site. This is exciting, said Drake University coach Allison Pullman of the event. All of the teams will be very, very ready to go. I love the fact that women's basketball has our own venue to offer a championship experience for all 12 teams. I think it goes to their student-athlete experience. I think it's phenomenal for us to be able to celebrate everybody together on Wednesday night at a banquet because all of these teams, to a certain degree, have earned a lot of different things as this season has gone on. Nobody has earned more recognition this season than Pullman's Bulldogs, who finished the regular season with a record of 26 wins and 5 losses and won the outright MVC regular season title with a 19-win, 1-loss mark. The Bulldogs, who come into the event with an 11-game win streak, haven't lost since a 79-70 road setback to Illinois State on January the 27th. A bullseye is firmly on the backs of the defending Hoops in the Heartland champs as they seek their fifth NCAA tournament bid in the last 7 seasons. Last year's title came as a number 4 seed. However, it is not just the Bulldogs seeking to keep their season alive. Last year, between the NCAA gathering, the WNIT, and WBI, the Valley sent half of its 12 teams into tournament play after the Hoops in the Heartland event. In the last 24 seasons, an average of 4 Valley teams per season have been involved in the action. Yes, there is a good brand of basketball being played in the Valley, and it's recognized across the country. It might be possible to get that many involved again this year. 5 teams come into this week with at least 19 victories. Top-seeded Drake, number 2 Belmont, number 3 Missouri State, number 5 Illinois State, and number 6 Murray State. 4th-seeded UNI finished Valley play with a solid 14-6 mark, but an early season injury to North Scott High School graduate Grace Buffelli left the Panthers off to a 1-9 start against a very difficult schedule. 6 MVC teams are ranked in the top 120 of the latest NCAA net rankings. Drake leads that pack at number 67, followed by Belmont at 73, UNI at 97, Murray State at 110, Missouri State at 115, and Illinois State at 118. Teresa.
Bears add Ripien offensive lineman Pryor. This is out of Lake Forest, Illinois. The Chicago Bears agreed to one-year contracts with backup quarterback Brett Rypien and offensive lineman Matt Pryor on Wednesday. Rypien has played in 10 games and started four over three seasons with Denver and one with the Los Angeles Rams. He appeared in two games and started one for Los Angeles in 2023. He also spent time on practice squads with the New York Jets and Seattle Seahawks. He played for new Bears offensive coordinator Shane Waldron with Seattle. The 6'7", 332-pound Pryor has played in 75 games and started 24 for Philadelphia, Indianapolis, and San Francisco since the Eagles drafted him in the sixth round in 2018. The team also finalized a three-year contract with running back DeAndre Swift and two-year deals with tight end Gerald Everett and safety Jonathan Owens on Wednesday. Chicago finished 7-10 last season. The Bears have the number 1 and number 9 overall picks in the NFL draft next month. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Scott Splavik. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.